For 91.3 FM, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook and visit arsenalfordemocracy.com to read the articles referenced in this episode. This is Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island, from the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. This is episode 301, being recorded on the evening of Sunday, March 22nd, 2020. Joining me, as always, on the line is Rachel in Idaho. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
We're going to be staying away from talking about the pandemic this week, since we've done that the past 2 weeks in a row. You can be assured that we're probably coming back to it soon in future episodes. We had promised a few weeks ago in episode 298 that we were going to return to the topic of tax havens. In that episode, we were mostly talking about white-collar crime and actual tax evasion stuff. We're going to be focusing more on tax avoidance and tax havens this week, both internationally and nationally, of course, with the state of Delaware being one of the big ones. And our show is flagshipped out of WVUD at the University of Delaware campus. So, Rachel, let's start by talking again about an IMF Finance and Development article from 2019 that you had read certain parts of in episode 298. Recap a little bit of that for us and kind of some of the positions taken in that piece. This was kind of an opinion-ish piece, basically.
Right. So just to recap, here's some parts that I probably did touch on the last episode, but I just want to really reiterate how big of a problem it is. So this is a quote from that article. Tax havens collectively cost governments between $500 billion and $600 billion a year in lost corporate tax revenue, depending on the estimate. Through legal and not so legal means. Of that lost revenue, low income economies account for some $200 billion, a larger hit as a percentage of GDP than advanced economies, and more than the $150 billion or so they receive each year in foreign development assistance. American Fortune 500 companies alone held an estimated $2.6 trillion, with a T, dollars offshore in 2017, though a small portion of that has been repatriated following U.S. tax reforms in 2018. So the big points from that I touched on in the last time we talked about it and really want to touch on again is that these low income economies are hurt the most by having the money taken out of their government, out of their countries. So the money going out is a bigger part than the money coming in from foreign development assistance. So it would be better for these governments to just make sure that they are collecting the taxes from their businesses rather than accepting aid money from other countries.
One of the points that we emphasized on that episode, and we're going to continue to emphasize, as has been the traditional position of my radio shows for 10 years now this April, is that it is possible to do taxes based on the value that is generated in that particular constituency or country. And we talked about previously on that other episode about the Boston Globe article regarding taxation of railroads during the early period of significant rail development across the United States. But essentially, it is possible to avoid the problem of just, oh, we closed the tax loopholes and all the companies left the country, and moved their business elsewhere. yes, some of that might happen in some of these cases if they were actually willing to pick up their production and go somewhere else. But in many cases, a lot of the revenue that they're generating, especially if they're a retail company, right, and that the money is being generated on the consumer end, you can structure these taxes to say, hey, you made your money in this country. You should be paying the taxes in this country. And we're going to be talking later in this episode about the United States specifically, not just the low income countries as well.
Furthermore, in May, this must be May of 2019, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development published a roadmap proposing reforms based on two pillars. First, determining where tax should be paid on and on what basis and what portion of profit should be taxed on that basis. And second, getting multinationals to pay a minimum level of tax. So this OECD is a group of people from rich countries that kind of set the standard for international tax law. So the fact that these countries are actually coming together and realizing this is a problem came about because of the publication of the Panama Papers that kind of really... even though it didn't really last in the news cycle that long, it did really shock people. And so it kind of spurred on this talk of reform. The plan that they were discussing was considered really radical and would have been almost inconceivable before the publishing of the Panama Papers. I think I mentioned the Tax Justice Network, which the author of this article worked with, now sees its four core demands, initially dismissed as utopian, gaining global traction: automatic exchange of financial information across borders, public registers of beneficial ownership of financial assets, country-by-country reporting, and now unitary tax with formula apportionment. And I believe we talked about that apportionment concept last time.
Yeah, so that's the idea that you are calculating the taxes not based on where the headquarters of a company is or where the subsidiary is based. You know, if it's in a Caribbean country or if it's in Ireland or the Netherlands or wherever, you're calculating the tax based on the importance of that country to the supply chain or to the demand market or some service they're providing the company, which again we will get into further when we talk about Delaware specifically. The idea that, like, if a railroad passes through your county or an oil pipeline passes through your county, it cannot generate its full value at the end of the line without having generated some of the value by passing through your jurisdiction. So there should be some accounting for that and taxation of that, rather than just saying, well, sure, we sold all of our, you know, iPhones in this country, but technically we're headquartered in this other country, so we don't actually have to pay taxes here.
Right. So I think there's just a push to be a lot more transparent with where the money is flowing from and where the money is flowing to, which is a really good thing. Another thing he pointed out is we need to be asking the question, do the financial flows attracted by tax havens help the receiving countries? They certainly help interest groups there, emphasis his, typically in the banking, accounting, legal, and real estate professions, but do they benefit the jurisdiction as a whole? Again, emphasis his. So I think that's something we definitely need to look at, like, especially in the case of, I think, Ireland is a big tax haven for Apple. I think we'll discuss it later, but like the Netherlands is a big tax haven in the EU, Switzerland.
Well, and also, you know, as we're going to talk about in just a few moments or a few minutes, with regard to Nevada, that became an important question. That's one of the reasons that the state of Nevada became a so-called onshore tax haven, was that issue of, like, well, we have to come up with a patch to the budget somehow. And then the question is this benefiting the state as a whole? If you eliminate this tax haven thing, how are you then compensating those states, et cetera? Or is this something that only benefits, you know, the people who are doing the registrations or doing the legal shenanigans and so forth? Because, of course, with the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers, a lot of that was about, you know, specific law firms, which we talked about in the last episode, you know, that their whole specialization organization is just figuring out how to hide their clients' money, whether they're individuals or companies. We were mostly talking about individuals on the last on the episode 298, which is why we're focusing on the corporate side this time. But it's certainly all kind of related. Let's talk now, before we get to the onshore tax havens, about the report Offshore Shell Games by U.S. PIRG in 2017, as well as the ITEP, Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy, which we'll also be circling back to with regard to Delaware. This is something that in every several years they did a U.S. PIRG did a report on this. I wrote about it in 2015, or the 2015 report that they released. And Nate and I, as well as our former co-host Persephone, discussed it on episode 147. There will be a link in our usual list of links about what we're talking about this week. There will be a link back to episode 147, so you can go listen to that one if you want to hear about the 2015 report. But there is a more recent report, 2017. The main findings of this report are: most of America's largest corporations maintain subsidiaries in offshore tax havens. At least 366 companies, or 73% of the Fortune 500, operate one or more subsidiaries in tax haven countries. All told, these 366 companies maintain at least 9,755 tax haven subsidiaries. The 30 companies with the most money officially booked offshore for tax purposes operate 2,213 tax haven subsidiaries. The most popular tax haven among the Fortune 500 is the Netherlands, as Rachel just noted, with more than half of the Fortune 500 reporting at least one subsidiary there. Approximately 57% of the companies with tax haven subsidiaries have set up at least one in Bermuda or the Cayman Islands. Fortune 500 companies are holding more than $2.6 trillion in accumulated profits offshore for tax purposes. Just four of these companies, Apple, Pfizer, Microsoft, and General Electric, account for a quarter of the total. Just 30 Fortune 500 companies account for 68%, or $1.76 trillion, of these offshore profits. If we assume that the average tax rate of 6.1% applies to all 293 Fortune 500 companies with offshore earnings, they would owe a 28.9% rate upon repatriation of these earnings, meaning that they would collectively owe $752 billion in additional federal taxes if the money were repatriated at once. So some pretty grim statistics there, especially as we're watching the U.S. economy completely melt down and the federal government having to find money out of, thin air, essentially, to spend on critical things. And we look at how many billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars, these companies have been stashing overseas to get to 0% taxes paid.
Yeah, I think it's hard to conceptualize, like, just for the normal layperson, the enormity of this. Like, just reading those numbers, it boggles my mind that these companies have been allowed to accumulate this much profit and is allowed to basically hide it away from the very countries that actually allowed them to succeed, or that they exploited and extracted extra wealth from. Like, it's just insane to think about the trillion with a T. Like, that number, I don't think it's possible for a normal person to actually think about numbers on that scale.
All right, let's move to talking about the onshore side of this, because of course we've heard a lot about these Caribbean islands and these European entities and so forth. And those are definitely a problem, but let's talk about U.S. onshore tax havens now. There are about four states to which this applies: Delaware, Nevada, Wyoming, and South Dakota. We're going to specifically talk today about Delaware and Nevada. Delaware will be coming up in just a few minutes, so please stick with us on that, but we're going to talk first about Nevada. So this was something that, I had heard about Nevada being an onshore tax haven maybe 10, 15 years ago or so, probably in an article in The Economist or something like that. But it got a lot more attention after the Panama Papers came out in 2016. We started seeing more detailed articles in places like The Atlantic or McClatchy. And we're going to have the links for that, as usual, in a PDF up at arsenalfordemocracy.com when this episode airs. And they were turning a brighter spotlight onto how Nevada operates and, as we discussed earlier in this episode, the question of why these things get set up and who benefits from them. So the article in The Atlantic looked back at some of the, you know, mid-2000s era pre-recession period of this, they said in 2007, the Nevada Secretary of State's website asked, why incorporate in Nevada? The answer, quote, minimal reporting and disclosing requirements. Stockholders are not public record, end quote. Nevada loosened its corporation laws in 1991, according to the Las Vegas Sun, hoping to make it a Delaware of the West and attract corporations with its low taxes and high secrecy. It made tens of millions of dollars. In 2006 alone, the Las Vegas Sun reported that the state took in $87 million. One of the companies that made its way there was Rothschild Wealth Management and Trust, a firm with a storied history that was looking to move after a crackdown on Swiss banks. It chose Reno. According to Bloomberg Businessweek, putting assets into a Nevada LLC, in turn owned by a Nevada trust, would generate no U.S. tax returns. This was according to a guy who was a managing director at Rothschild Wealth Management and Trust. Any forms the IRS would receive would result in, quote, no meaningful information to exchange under, end quote, agreements between Hong Kong and the U.S. And this was for an example of avoiding taxes or reporting disclosure stuff between the U.S. and China. Because oftentimes they try to frame this as, oh, we're just legitimately trying to conceal individuals or corporations' resources and holdings. But now, if we turn to a McClatchy article also following up after the Panama Papers, they had a slightly different narrative. Now, the earlier article of The Atlantic had emphasized the 1991 reforms in Nevada, which obviously played a part, but there was also a subsequent situation. So they passed relaxed incorporation laws in 2001 as explicitly an attempt to cover a severe budget shortfall that had happened after a mid-1990s constitutional amendment to the state constitution of Nevada requiring a legislative supermajority to pass any new taxes. A University of Nevada Las Vegas law professor noted that hostility toward the IRS in Nevada also made people unsympathetic to the claims that Nevada was aiding in domestic federal tax evasion. And now, or more recently, at least when the Panama Papers stuff had come out, the state was generating like $117 million or something like that per year on just the sort of registration process for the state. And that was, you know, a significant amount of money for the state to cover its budget shortfalls. Now, after the Panama Papers, Senator Wyden of Oregon sent a letter to the Nevada Secretary of State. And the response that he got back was Nevada Secretary of State Barbara K. Kagavsky said in a June 2nd response, this is in 2016, it was around then because that was when the Panama Papers came out. Anyway, said that her office does not have the authority to investigate illegal activities such as money laundering or tax evasion linked to Nevada registered companies. Moreover, she said that in the past 3 years, her office has not demanded ownership information from any companies because no law enforcement agency had asked for it. Now, I mean, in fairness to them, yeah, probably the Nevada Secretary of State's office doesn't have the resources to be conducting detailed background checks on all of these very obviously fake registrations that are being made, often by U.S. corporations or U.S. individuals. The other interesting thing here is that there's also this sort of cottage industry of guys in like Las Vegas or Reno or whatever, just registering thousands of corporations at their own homes and then being like, yeah, and I'll also install a phone line too if you want to have a nominal phone number that is a Nevada number that forwards to your actual number. And you can just, you know, get that set up at my house and you never have to come here in person. That is sort of one version of doing the tax havens onshore. I don't know if you had comments about that before we move on to Delaware.
Well, it's just interesting how secretive these states are allowed to be. Like, I guess I always assumed that stakeholders had to be public, but apparently that is not the case. And it's really easy to hide your name under like three or four different shell companies that just kind of hide information and you give people the runaround if they want to find out who is behind some of these companies.
Now, shortly before the Panama Papers, if we go to the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, ITEP, report from December of 2015 on Delaware, we can learn more about the Delaware-specific model. This is something that obviously, like, if you live in Delaware or if you've ever heard of Delaware, you're aware of on some level, but you might not know some of the specifics of how it works, right? There's a lot of discussion of, like, the, you know, the private mailboxes and stuff like that, you know, and buildings filled with thousands of corporations nominally because they have a box there. And that's certainly true, but there is more to it than that as well. So according to ITEP, Delaware ranks 46th in population among the 50 states with roughly 935,000 residents, but has 1.1 million companies incorporated there as of 2014, including 65% of Fortune 500 parent companies. Additionally, 85% of Fortune 500 companies reported having at least one subsidiary in Delaware in 2014. In total, these companies reported more than 19,000 Delaware subsidiaries. In sum, 58% of all reported U.S. subsidiaries and 30% of total reported subsidiaries are housed in Delaware. In contrast, the two states that account for the largest contribution to the nation's GDP, the actual economy, California and Texas, have only 1,160 and 1,540 Fortune 500 companies, respectively. So again, to compare, California and Texas, where actual economic activity is happening in many cases, have about 1,200, 1,500 subsidiary companies compared to 19,000 in Delaware. Delaware is also favored by foreign companies as a location for incorporating subsidiaries. A 2011 analysis of FTSE 100 companies, the largest businesses on the London Stock Exchange, found that they collectively had more than 2,000 subsidiaries registered in Delaware, which is more than double the number of subsidiaries that the FTSE 100 has in the Netherlands, the second most used tax haven. So again, we're now at a point where we're seeing that even a country like the Netherlands is playing second fiddle to the state of Delaware on the tax avoidance for corporations. So why are so many businesses drawn to incorporate in Delaware? This is where it starts getting a little bit more complicated, because this is the OG onshore tax haven, and so it is much more expansive than many of these other states in terms of their sort of infrastructure to make this possible. It's also, I would argue, probably more expansive, although I'm not defending it, than a lot of these Caribbean locations. The most popular answer, according to the ITEP report, is the state's business-friendly climate, quote-unquote. It has a dedicated corporate court system, the Chancery Court, producing a steady stream of case law, an enormous network of corporate lawyers and laws that favor management over shareholders. The legal benefits are likely a large draw for parent companies, but this cannot explain the disproportionate number of subsidiaries that choose Delaware over other states, since subsidiaries don't have the same types of legal and corporate governance issues. Another part of the appeal is the ease and rapidity with which a business entity can be formed there. Business entities can be set up in a number of hours, but the tax haven features of the state are a critical draw for individuals and corporations looking to engage in tax avoidance as well as illicit activities such as tax evasion and money laundering. But now we get to the even more interesting part, which is that whereas Nevada has no corporate tax and people are registering their companies in Nevada not just to obscure who's the shareholder or the company owner or whatever, but also to literally just not pay taxes, that's not even the case in Delaware. It says Delaware is not a typical zero tax jurisdiction, nor is it one of the states with no corporate income tax, Nevada, Wyoming, and South Dakota. But its tax code does contain a glaring loophole. It collects zero tax on income relating to intangible assets held by Delaware holding companies, or PICs, passive investment companies. This includes interest and investment income, as well as income related to intellectual property such as trademarks and patents. Sometimes called the Delaware loophole, or the PIC loophole, this allows corporations to set up holding companies in Delaware that the parent company or other subsidiaries then pay for the use of intellectual property. This income, unlike, say, standard corporate income, is not taxed in Delaware, while the payments can be deducted as a business expense from the parent company's tax liability in its home state. In effect, states where the companies are actually operating can lose millions of dollars in revenue as a result of the Delaware loophole. A 2012 New York Times article estimated that the loophole has cost states, again, we're talking about state governments that don't have a lot of margin to operate with in their budgets that have to be balanced, it cost states approximately $9.5 billion over a decade in lost revenues. One economic study analyzing Delaware's role as a domestic tax haven using data from over 2,500 firms from 1995 to 2009 estimated that firms using the Delaware PIC strategy reduced their state income tax liability by 15% to 24%, with the average firm saving an estimated $3.2 to $4.2 million. And one prominent example to illustrate this of a company's use of the Delaware PIC strategies was Toys R Us, RIP, as it resulted in a significant South Carolina Supreme Court decision in 1993. Toys R Us Inc. has a Delaware subsidiary, or had at the time of this report, Jeffrey LLC. On paper, Jeffrey LLC owns all of the company's trademarks and trade names, such as its mascot, Jeffrey the Giraffe. The retail Toys R Us stores in other states then pay royalties to Jeffrey LLC in Delaware for the use of these intangible assets. These revenues are not taxed in Delaware, and they can then deduct the royalties on their state tax returns in the states where they're actually operating. For example, in 1990, Jeffrey LLC received $55 million in royalty income, and Toys R Us was able to avoid an estimated $2.75 million in state taxes as a result of this strategy. And the final note that is at the end of the ITEP report, which is, I think, a good way of summarizing this, is that given the scale and scope of the basically legalized crime happening through the state of Delaware, it is unreasonable to expect other countries to make changes deterring tax haven and abuse and improving transparency without holding U.S. states, such as Delaware, Nevada, Wyoming, and South Dakota, to the same standards. Rachel, it's about time to wrap up the episode. Final thoughts?
Well, I've kind of heard on a surface level that Delaware is quote-unquote business-friendly, but I didn't realize the depth and breadth of Delaware's operations. So it's really mind-boggling to think about. I guess I miss Toys R Us a little bit less. I don't know that they deserve to get strapped with debt and raided for his assets, but they weren't exactly an innocent party themselves, I guess.
No, absolutely not. And again, you know, at this point, the ecosystem around tax avoidance in Delaware is vast, and a lot of people's jobs in Delaware depend directly or indirectly on this tax haven status. And the state is making some money on it, not just through registrations of the companies, but also because certain types of income are getting taxed in Delaware. The thing that has to be considered, though, is that other states are being robbed of tax revenue that should rightly be going to them by any reasonable standard. You cannot conduct your business operations without that. Similarly, you know, a bunch of these companies are benefiting from the legal system in Delaware and the court system in Delaware, which is all fine and good if they're at least contributing some money toward it. But the U.S. as a whole, as we talked about in the earlier part of the episode, is losing huge amounts of revenue. All of these companies are not paying their federal taxes, and it is also true that they are benefiting from the U.S. legal system as a whole, including but not limited to the state legal systems. And they should be paying taxes because they are only able to generate these profits and revenues by the grace of the United States economic and legal system, as well as the U.S. government. In general, there are state budgets that are having to be cut, critical services that are having to be cut that keep people alive because of the revenues that are lost to states like Delaware or to states like Nevada. That is something that people have to consider and live with in Delaware, the fact that their specialized tax avoidance system is hurting other people in other states. And taking the approach of a lot of the people quoted in the Nevada articles of being like, that's not our problem, is irresponsible and immoral in a society where we are responsible to one another, particularly in these troubling times that we're in now. Rachel, thank you very much for being on this week to talk about this.
Thanks, Bill.